This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
The Bloomberg Big Take today, a story in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, out on newsstands tomorrow, already online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's also on the Bloomberg Terminal. The story, Tim, taps into how traditional economic indicators, well, they can't predict the timing of a downturn. And then some of the newer forecasting methods, they're just kind of untested.
Yeah, this is why calling a U.S. recession is trickier than ever before, especially with all the mixed signals that we're getting. It is just not easy. We hear it over and over again.
It's not easy
from market
being a
participants,
U.S.
recession. From CFOs. It's tough. Yep. Here with the story, we got Bloomberg News U.S. economy reporter Katya Dmitrieva on Zoom via the 99.1 studio and Bloomberg Bureau in Washington, D.C., along with the editor of Business Week, Joel Weber. He's here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Come on, Joel. I thought this was easy. I thought all you had to do was be the National Bureau of Economic Research and you just, you know, say
wait
yes
for
or
a
no.
Year.
Look in your crystal ball
yeah,
and
I thought that's
tells
it.
You exactly when the recession may or may not
yeah.
come. Yeah, and on top of that, no pressure for economists here because they've had some noteworthy misses.
Oops.
You know, there's that inflation thing and some GDP.
Oh, those old things?
Yeah. So really what's happened here is this: there's been a proliferation of data. Everybody's got an opinion now, right, Katya? And what is the best we can come up with how to figure out how to call a recession?
Yeah, there's a lot of data. You know, in addition to the traditional indicators, you also have all of the new ones, you know, everything from the open table restaurant reservations to where people are flying and if they're flying, if they're coming back into the office, and then even things like plastic surgery. Some economists like to look at that as a gauge of sort of how much people are spending on things that are completely discretionary 99% of the time. So you have a lot of stuff to look at. And unfortunately, you know, unfortunately, it's no easier this time around with this data than it was, for example, during the last recession or pre-COVID, I should say, 2019, when everyone was thinking, okay, we're due for a recession.
The before times.
The before times, the PC, pre-COVID times. You know, I think right now, there is some indication of stress. There is some indication that things are slowing down. But the tricky thing is trying to figure out when you're piecing together all these different pieces of the economy, is the image that you get that we're entering a recession, or is it simply a renormalization and kind of a slowing down to something we might have seen in 2019? So that's what's proving very difficult for a lot of economists right now.
I'm so glad we're talking to you right now. We just spoke with Mario Cordero, who runs the port of Long Beach. And he was saying that, you know, we kind of like tried to hold his feet to the fire.
We did.
And get him to say whether or not we're in a recession, whether or not he sees one coming. I mean, this is a guy who can look out his window and see the economic activity, you know, how many ships are lined up and the economic activity that's taking part. And he wouldn't, he was like, I'm on team soft landing, but he like wasn't comfortable making a call.
We said like yes or no, and he wouldn't do it.
Yeah, he wouldn't do it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the exact same experience that you're going to get with a lot of other economists right now. I mean, even Claudia Sahm, you know, she created the Sahm rule. This is sort of when you talk about art versus science and economy, this is pretty much as sciencey as you can get. You know, it's a line on a chart. It tracks the unemployment rate over time compared to the sort of past 12 months unemployment rate. And it is very accurate in terms of predicting at a certain point okay, we've entered a recession. And yet, even when I was chatting with her, she was saying, you know, I hope that it's wrong this time around. And there's a chance that it might be wrong this time around, because the consumer outlook is still pretty strong. And we haven't seen a lot of kind of impact, negative impact in the labor market yet. And again, I mean, we could enter a situation where consumer spending manages to hold up, right? So we saw the retail sales figures for the past few months pretty dismal, but we're coming off of that high, right? So we could enter a situation where companies have a bit more room to cut prices now, now that the Fed has kind of done its job and we're seeing inflation slow down a bit. And then we could have consumers saying, okay, I'm going to keep spending. Maybe not like I did 2 years ago or a year ago, but, you know, I'm going to keep this economy going. Everyone's going to keep doing their part. So it's just still a big question mark. I'll, you know, 1,200 words later, you know, 20 economist interviews later, and it's still
TBD.
I'll do my part. So what about the yield curve? Because that's then, as you write, a tried and true recession indicator. Does it still hold as much weight as we've always thought, or is it sort of slightly maybe less, and these other things kind of take into account? Like, what's the new, you know, the new thinking on inverted yield curves?
Yeah, the yield curve is a funny one. People love it, and it's a great indicator of what investors are thinking and whether they see kind of a recession down the road. And it's pretty straightforward when sort of the short versus long term the curve inverts. Like, it's a signal. It's one signal of many signals.
But how does it compare with a drop in sales of men's underwear?
Yeah, I know. Alan Greenspan's favorite, or used to be his favorite indicator. You know, it's more accurate than a lot of other indicators. The thing with the yield curve inversion, though, is that there could be a false positive. So we had one in the 1960s where the yield curve inverted and we didn't have a recession immediately afterwards. And we also had the yield curve inverting twice, at least twice last year. And we're, you know, I mean, you could talk to some economists, they'd argue we're already in a recession, but we don't see the traditional signs of a recession right this very second. So you could maybe even call that a false positive. So with a lot of these indicators, like, you really have to take them all together. So yield curve plus the SOM rule plus, you know, for example, the Conference Board's leading indicator index, which is weakening and flashing red.
Katya, I'm just going to wait for a year when everybody says, oh, guess what? We were in a recession
a
year.
All of them say to say, oh, it already happened.
Hey, listen, how does, though, there's a great soundbite in your story, or a great quote about how this is the most traditional of traditional recessions in a couple of decades, right? The last two we know, right? We had the financial meltdown, the housing crisis, that's one. And then you had a pandemic that shut down the economy. 30 seconds left here. It being traditional makes it easier or harder to call?
It makes it just as hard to call. I mean, we're lucky this time in that right now we don't have a black swan event, at least not yet, fingers crossed, like we did for the last two, especially the last pandemic recession. But it doesn't make it any easier. In fact, I would argue it makes it harder, because you're seeing, you know, kind of a slowdown of demand, but you're also seeing these mixed signals of like positive things happening in the economy. So I would say it's just as hard as it was before.
It's not easy calling a U.S. recession. That's it. What a great story, and so relevant, certainly to all of our conversations we're having. Katya Dmitrieva, she is U.S. economy reporter at Bloomberg News via Zoom from Washington, D.C. Thanks to her, along with Jill Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. This is Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovek on Bloomberg Radio.
We want to get to our next guest, because our big take today, a story in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek, it's talking about how traditional economic indicators can't predict the timing of a downturn. We keep, you know, talking about when a recession, what kind of recession, so on and so forth. I think a great indicator is anything to do with transportation.
Yeah, one indicator you could say that has often been relied on as a good gauge of economic health is anything to do with transport, Carol. And we're lucky to have back with us to that end Mario Cordero, executive director at the Port of Long Beach, who joins us via Zoom in Long Beach, California. Mario, good to have you with us. How are you?
Well, thank you. Thank you for the kind invitation.
Well, talk to us about activity at the ports. We've spoken to you a couple times throughout the last 2 years. How many ships right now are off the coast waiting to get in?
Zero. So we essentially have no vessel backup since back in November 2022. So it's essentially a great success here in the largest complex for the United States here in terms of containerized cargo.
Would you say that things are back to quote unquote normal as they were, you know, before the pandemic?
Well, overall, with regard to the fluidity here in the Port of Long Beach, I would say it's back to normal. Obviously, on the other hand, the nation's supply chain, there's still some work ahead, but again, far better than where we were a year ago.
So tell us what changed. Is it that there's more truckers to pick up the goods off of ships? There's more workers to get the goods off of ships, or there's less ships coming in? I know that there's a lot of factors we could look at. What is different?
Well, there's a combination of factors, but I think the bottom line here with the economy is, as we all know, the imports that come into our nation's gateways and the numbers reflect where we are in our economy. So the good news is I think we're doing very well in terms of the surge that we had, that we handled here 20 million containers at the St. Peter Bay complex, that is together the Port of Long Beach, Los Angeles. So the economy has slowed, but I think we all have to agree that to a certain extent, it's an intention here, given the Federal Reserve and their attempts to control the inflationary rate that we were experiencing in 2022. So part of that plan of action is to slow the economy. And the holiday season, though it was successful, it did was lower than the expectation that some people thought. And so I think you're starting to see that the consumer demand is dissipating. And the other and last aspect to this is we had very, very high inventories in the fourth quarter of 2022 because of the cargo that was moved here from Asia ahead of time, given the surge and all the bottleneck issues that we were experiencing in 2022.
Right. We talked about that with companies, right? They built up their inventories because they didn't want to be caught off guard and without goods that consumers want. And as a result, they didn't need to ship in new. So that makes a lot of sense. When you say that the economy has slowed, so the activity that you're seeing, Mario, the level of economic activity, is it similar to what we saw just pre-pandemic? Or is it below that level? Give us some more context. You're someone who understands the levels in and out, different economic down, you know, different economic cycles. So give us a little bit more perspective and color.
Thank you. We are getting to pre-pandemic in many metrics. But keep in mind, and when you look at the economy and the inflationary rate for December, we're now at a 6.5%. Given the peak of what we were experiencing in the summer.
6.5% of what?
No, 7.1% year to year in terms of the inflationary rate.
Okay, inflation.
Yeah.
So that was in November. In December, we went down to 6.5%. So when you look in terms of what that rate was in the height of the escalating inflationary issue, upwards of 9%, again, good metric in terms of, again, what the Federal Reserve is doing as to monetary policy. The second point to that is, we could all agree how much the supply chain was part of the phraseology used by the Federal Reserve in terms of factors that were causing inflation. So the good news, at least for the supply chain, we are not high on the list anymore in terms of those inflationary factors. And I'm talking about supply chain disruption and, of course, transportation costs. You know, with regard to the West Coast, the transportation costs from Asia to the West Coast are now back to a normal type of setting. So again, to your question, yes, I think we're seeing now a semblance of normalization that is pre-pandemic numbers here.
Maybe it's a good thing that President Biden isn't visiting your port anymore as he did, you know, in June of last year, right?
Yes, and I think I credit to the White House envoy, first was John Picardi and now General Stephen Lyons, and bringing all the stakeholders together to try to address these various challenges we had here going back to the COVID-19 impacts.
We're talking with Mario Cordero, Executive Director at the Port of Long Beach via Zoom in Long Beach, California. Mario, when you say transportation costs back to normal, is that though still inflated because there's still inflation in those numbers or no?
Well, I think transportation costs back to normal. You know, we had about a 90% reduction of what that containerized cargo costs to bring the container from Asia to the West Coast. And I think in large part is the capacity question. You know, we have more capacity here now. And of course, the carriers are canceling sailings because of that diminished import number. And when I say diminished import number, it's not just a question of the West Coast. It's diminished import number overall to the nation. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the good news, if you ask any of these international carriers and the American and the shipper, you know, bottom line, the market here is in the USA in terms of consumer demand. So despite the diminishment of that consumer demand, we are in a very good setting in terms of going back to pre-pandemic numbers.
Just in the last minute we have with you, Mario, any indication to you that we're going into a recession?
Or already there? Because some say that we could be like kind of right there right now.
Well, I think, you know, there are those who talk about a soft landing, and I'm in that category. And of course, there were those, if you go back to the summer and spring of 2022, who were predicting a serious recession of a magnitude level.
Right.
We're not there. So I think the good news is, I think you're starting to see that, number one, the important thing, that CPI, the consumer price index, is diminishing. And of course, on the other hand, with regard to the recessionary numbers, I think there's still a lot of optimism among the economists that we're not going to have the type of recession that some people fear. So the good news is, yes, there's a cycle here,
right,
and I think it's going to be a mild one that we're going to go through. So hopefully
but
we're all correct on that side of the column. So I look forward to 2023, right, a second half better than the first half will be.
But yes or no, we're not there in a recession yet? Yes or no?
No, we're not there in terms of a serious recession.
Mario Cordero, thank you so much. Executive Director at the Port of Long Beach, joining us from California. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
A story about how startups are getting created, are creating what they are doing. They're getting creative, I should say, when they are in the hunt for crash and for cash. Can I try that again?
You got it. It's Wednesday. I know. That's, these things happen, Carol.
It's hump day. Just like they're getting creative, I'm getting creative. But some of that creativity is raising eyebrows.
Well, we got a great voice with us. He's quoted in this story. Ken Smythe, he's from Next Round Capital Partners. He helps startups obtain financing. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Ken, good to have you with us. You know, As we heard Charlie going through the markets, you were telling us a little bit about, you know, your impressions of Elon Musk and, you know, how he overpaid for Twitter, ahead of Tesla earnings this afternoon. The environment has shifted so much just in the past year. What are you seeing in the work that you're doing when you're out there helping startups raise money?
First, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. We're seeing an environment which has drastically shifted in the last 12 months, particularly. I think investors obviously are kind of coming off a very, very rosy scenario, which was 2020, 2021, where multiples were sky high and people were paying for growth at any cost. And now we're back to fundamentals, as they say. And investors are really focused on when companies are going to be profitable, when they're going to be cash break even, and particularly what multiples are they paying now for that future growth, given interest rate headwinds, the Fed, and a potential recession.
So a smarter market today in terms of focusing on fundamentals, where it got a little stupid when there was so much cheap money for so long?
It got super crazy. Some firms, and I won't name names, were doing, you know, 10 deals a week, right? How can you keep that pace and really be doing serious diligence on these companies? So what we're seeing now is really kind of a very much a pullback, a very much focus on what's going to work not only now, but in several years from now, and durable business models.
What I want to ask you, Ken, is though, in a market like this, does it create companies that will ultimately be your Googles, your Facebooks, dare I say Twitter, you know, the companies that actually have longer legs and sustainability going forward because of the focus on fundamentals?
Absolutely. You're going to see companies that really were sort of cash burning machines that needed venture capital to continue growing. Right, they could continue to feed losses, and a lot of the consumer models, if you look back at Casper mattresses, if you look back at Lime, at Bird, these were ideas that just consumed massive amounts of money that VCs had to continue funding at ever-raising rounds and ever-raising prices. And when that's working and money is cheap, it's great. You can run a business like that all day long, but when the tide goes out, as Warren Buffett says, you know, look out below, right? Investors are just not willing to fund those losses indefinitely.
So what's the environment that exists right now in the context of the new companies that are out there being created? Are we in a more normalized world of, you know, I don't know, the 1990s perhaps, where we see interest rates not at zero?
Right. So now I believe we're in the sort of 2009 period, call 2022, 2008 for the venture capital IPO market.
That's pretty severe.
Where everything ground to a halt.
Wow.
And 2007 was 2021.
Okay. Right. But what came after that? It was like the best time ever to be a venture capitalist.
That's right. And a lot of the venture capitalists hadn't seen a 2022 yet. Remember, a lot of these firms got started in 2010, 2011, 2012.
Right.
All they knew was a bull market. If you were an employee started working for a startup, you got all these options and all you saw them is go straight up, straight up, straight up. And you never sold a share and you were the smartest person in the world, because then you had the IPO, the lockup, and you were rich. And that's all you had to do is just keep doing that over and over again. Now venture capitalists are starting to have to think like hedge fund managers almost. They have to say, you know, if Chime was at $25 billion a year ago, and that was at 100 times multiple, and now Chime is trading at $10 billion, and potentially if it was public down to $6 billion, should I have sold a lot a year ago? Do I need to start actually managing a portfolio?
Right.
Because this whole buy and hold thing in the VC world isn't going to work in every environment. They got lucky, and it worked for a while, but it's just not going to work indefinitely.
Chime, one of those startup, you know, so-called neobanks.
That's right.
So what does this mean for startups who do need cash? I mean,
right.
Hema Parmar, who wrote this story, she's our hedge fund reporter here at Bloomberg News. She talked about how startups are having to be creative in terms of the hunt for cash. So what are they doing?
Yeah, I think
what does that mean, and what do they have to promise, or what do they have to do?
I think early stage startups, if we've defined the world by early stage, mid stage companies, Series C, Series D, and then late stage post Series E, when you really have a business going on, I think a lot of what I was talking about in the article was companies that have already raised money. They have significant businesses going on, 100 million, 200 million, 300 million in revenues, but are still burning cash, right?
Right.
And so they have a certain amount of cash, and kind of 2002 was sort of a freebie. 2022, sorry, was a freebie. You raise a lot of money in 21. You had plenty of cash to get through 22. Now you're hoping as a CFO, you wake up and this all goes away, right? Because you don't want to go out and raise money at a 40% discount or a 50% discount to what you did in 21.
Hence the down round.
Down round, right? Not only that, but you got employees and executives to keep happy,
right?
And if you wipe out their equity, guess what? You got a lot of upset people walking around the office saying, hey, what did you do?
So what do they do?
So this is going to be the interesting part. 2023 and mid part this year into 2024 is the rubber is going to meet the road. Every CFO is going to have to say, what's this? Where are we going with this? Do I keep growing my business?
Right.
Or do I dilute my investors and wipe out my equity of my employees? Right. And that's going to be the big dilemma. So you see companies like Sneak that just did a down round. They got a major free pass, only down 15%,
not bad.
From their previous round. If you can do that, you should do that all day long. But I think companies, but Sneak is in a SaaS software high margin business, so they can probably get away with it.
Right.
But if you're Instacart trying to raise money now or GoPuff, good luck.
Yeah, we've seen, I mean, we've written about the challenges that those companies are facing quite a bit in Business Week. So I guess my question is about the types of businesses that are going to come of age during this period of higher rates and, you know, where the money isn't free anymore.
That's right.
Are these going to be just better businesses? Are you optimistic, or are you kind of?
I'm very optimistic.
You're not
concerned. I'm almost glad this has happened,
right? Right?
Because it's making CFOs and companies actually have to be aware of cost, be aware of how much money they're burning of investors' money to grow these businesses.
You mean
be thoughtful about hiring, and hiring and right sizing your organization, and not just throwing money at problems, because that's what everyone got punched drunk on free money. So if you're just punched drunk on free money, you're going to hire as many people as you want. You're going to invest as much money into sales and marketing.
So
you're going to go after bad product ideas, and they may or may not work. But do you care? There's this VC standing by and wanting to give you more money.
Correct. What are the opportunities then?
The opportunities are in virtual reality, companies like Anduril. The opportunities, although I think it's a...
Anduril, the defense
that's
company.
That's right. I think companies
like
Anduril... It's a Palmer
Bucky company. He's the guy who created Oculus, sold it to Facebook. Now he's trying to take on
that's
the likes
right.
of Raytheon.
Anduril is one of our top requested names. Obviously, let's not talk about OpenAI, but OpenAI is kind of the new, let's just say, darling of the private world.
Right.
And we're going to see a shakeout in that world. I think I can... that world to when Yahoo was the leader in search, and then Google came along and actually made it a business, right? And so that's what we're kind of seeing with AI, is who can actually make it into a workable business model.
Right.
We're seeing a lot in logistics and transportation, companies like Flexport. Mm-hmm. And then we're also seeing a lot of the SaaS businesses, which do cloud data storage, AI, machine learning, Databricks, Data Robot, companies that actually are helping businesses be more efficient with very high profit margins in the interim.
Hey, Kit, does it also mean that companies will go to public sooner rather than later?
I don't think so. I think we're in a very interesting period where investors are willing to pay a certain multiple. And
right.
if you look at public company multiples that are comparable, and if you're a private company CFO, you might say, you know what, it's probably better to stay private for right now.
Because, I agree, but because it's a different environment, there isn't so much cheap money. It's not going to force some companies to have to tap the public markets. Do you think there'll be enough out there?
I think that when companies do start raising money again in the private market, if the appetite is there and they can do it at the right price, they're going to try to stay private until the market recovers, and then you can go public at a higher multiple. Remember, businesses in software that are growing at 20% are selling for 5x multiple in the public market. You know, a lot of these private businesses are trending 25 times more plus.
So that trend continues, because it's something that Tim and I talk a lot about. It just kind of floors us when we go to different conferences. We were out at Milken, and it was all about the private markets. That trend continues, that the private markets are going to continue to fund so much out there. Just got about 30 seconds.
That's right. Look,
that doesn't change.
A lot of the best ideas are the early stage ideas. VCs, if you're a VC that caught OpenAI early, you're sitting on 100 times your money. That is where the real money is made. You got to catch them early enough, though. So, you know, many times once they get too late, just like Uber had raised so many financing rounds, by the time it went public, it went down 40%.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just got to catch the timing right. But this is innovation. We're going to pay for it. There's going to be a bull market again. And, you know, stay positive and look at fundamentals.
All right. We certainly will. Ken Smyth, thank you so much. Next Round Capital Partners founder joining us in our Bloomberg Interactive studio. Check out Hema Parmar, our hedge fund reporter at Bloomberg News. Her story talks about exactly what Ken just laid out for us.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
Chinese ADRs, they have been on a tear this year. The Nasdaq Golden Dragon China Index of Chinese ADRs that trade here in the U.S., it's up about 18% year-to-date, up 77% since October 24th of last year. Mind you, it's still way off its highs that we saw back a couple of years ago.
It is. The EMQQ, Emerging Markets Internet and E-Commerce ETF, invests in the space and is up nearly 18% in the past month, 58% in the past 3 months. It's a lot of numbers.
Yeah, sorry. But
that's no, it makes sense, though.
A lot of perspective, because we just want, this sector has been on fire and has really seen a pretty strong bounce back as of late.
We've got a great voice on this to give us more on the space, which includes companies like Tencent, Alibaba, Pinduoduo, JD.com, Baidu, and more. Kevin Carter is with us. He's the founder of EMQQ, joining us on the phone from San Francisco. Good to have you with us, Kevin. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so Carol talks about this space all the time.
I'm a little obsessed.
I made a point today by telling her, you haven't talked about, you know, Chinese internet companies that are traded here in the U.S. at once this week, which is just like such an anomaly for her. But you do it for good reason, Carol, because these are really important companies and it's a really important economy. It's the second biggest economy in the world. That said, investors are a little scared of it over the past couple of years, given what we saw with COVID in China and given trade tensions between the U.S. and China. In addition to that, what's the Chinese government going to do with these big companies? So what's the thesis that you have for having exposure to this space?
Sure. Well, you know, the thesis of EMQQ is pretty simple. You've got 6.5 billion people in emerging markets, and they're becoming consumers. First and foremost, they want more and better food, clothing, appliances, etc. They're getting their first computer ever, and it's happening today. And it's not a desktop; it's a $60 Android-based smartphone. And they're getting the internet for the first time when they get that smartphone. And because they don't have a Target store, they don't have a bank account. They're even more digital than we are. So think of it as the FANG stocks for, you know, the other 90% of the world's people. And China's the biggest part of that story, and China's been the biggest part of what we do. And it's also the biggest e-commerce market in the world. I mean, China might be an emerging market in a traditional sense, but when it comes to, you know, smartphones and e-commerce and all things related, China's the most developed country on the planet. And, you know, in many ways, they are the Jetsons.
So it's obviously a China play. That's your biggest, you know, when it comes to geography, your big exposure, but you do have exposure to South Korea, India, and elsewhere around the world. And you do track the Emerging Markets Internet Index. You are beholden to the index. And I guess what I want to ask you, while there has been quite a bounce back as of late, Kevin, the index, the area, it's still down about 60% from the high back in mid-February of 2021. And it's still a group that in many ways with that China exposure is beholden to what the Chinese government and regulators there do. That's a big variable, I would say, if you look at the last couple of years. So why risk that exposure?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. The last couple of years up until October, the end of October, this was a horrible place to be investing. The from the top to the bottom, I think at one point we were down about 80%. And, you know, the first part of that were all the China concerns that you alluded to. And essentially, there were two different China fears and risks that were just troubling investors over that period. And the first was the so-called China tech crackdown, which I don't think people quite understand. I think that really that it really
What do people not understand about the China tech crackdown?
Well, first of all over the planet, the internet platforms, you know, they've grown so fast that no regulators have been able to keep up. And you don't have to look very far. Every day you'll see one of the FANG stocks in the newspaper for getting fined or.
I mean, look at what we saw with Merrick Garland yesterday.
Exactly. And in Europe as well. I mean, Google pays, you know, goodness knows how many billions of dollars in fines they pay a year. So this isn't a China specific thing. The only problem is people are so conditioned to be afraid of the Chinese government that when they do something, instead of being, you know, regulatory, you know, worded in a favorable way, it's a crackdown. And I, you know, I've been involved with investing in China for 18 years. And, you know, I've gone through, as they happened, each of the four regulatory issues from the Ant Group IPO canceled to the online education, rule change. And every one of those things were very sensible to me that the government did. I mean, they cost us a little money. There were fines and the fintech rules changed so that the, you know, the fintech companies aren't as valuable. But either way, it looks like that's behind us. However you want to characterize it as a crackdown and, you know, things like Jack Ma's missing, fine. But if you look and listen to the Chinese government, at least over the last 12 weeks, it's over. They did their regulatory.
But wait a minute.
But can't they? Yeah. They can just change their mind.
I mean, President Xi has proved he's willing to sacrifice economic growth before and other priorities in exchange for control. Kevin, that we've seen that time and time again. How do you know that that doesn't change again?
Well, it certainly could change again. But if you listen to, you know, his most recent comments on the matter, he is, and China has a lot of problems, by the way. And I think, you know, they're trying to get this tension behind them. And so the at the highest level, they have stated that the regulatory crackdown is over. But you're right. They could change their minds and go any number of different directions. But let me just say that was the one big fear. The second big fear was the delisting risk and the D word, which I spent more time on this than, unfortunately, almost anything in my career. And it was so intellectually dishonest on so many levels and had such a low chance of happening. And more importantly, a very low chance that anyone loses any money. I mean, people don't seem to understand that a stock market is different than a share of ownership and a corporation, and whether it trades here or there or somewhere else, no one's going to steal your shares. But people didn't understand that. And anytime the D word showed up, it crushed the stocks. Now, this has also been somewhat resolved. You can go to the PCAOB website and they'll tell you that they went and did their exams in Hong Kong in October and they felt they had full access to what they needed, and it should be something that's behind us now.
Is it fair to say that being bullish on this area requires you to have faith in the Chinese government in a way that you don't have to have faith in other governments when you're investing in those regions?
Let me say one important thing. We have a second offering, which is called FMQQ, which is the same thing without China. So for people that don't like China, or maybe they already own a China product and they don't want China, you can buy the story without China. But the reality is that, you know, emerging markets are risky and emerging markets governments are volatile. And, you know, we've seen what's happened in Russia. And it really doesn't matter what form of government you had. If the leader goes crazy, then you may be in trouble. But here's what's exciting about this story. Let's move beyond the China part, because China, you know, China's e-commerce market's the most developed, you know, as I said, on the planet by mm-hmm. far. It's four times as big as all of the other 45 emerging markets combined. And that's why it's been about 80% of the revenue from this emerging markets internet sector. But now India, the rest of Southeast Asia, which is very young, especially relative to the West and to right. China, the rest of Southeast Asia, you've got 5.5 billion people beyond China in what we call the next frontier emerging markets.
Right.
And those people are just getting their smartphones today and they're getting online for the first time. And the growth there over the next decade is going to be stunning.
Well, and as you said, the FMQQ, South Korea and India, it looks like are your top geographic holdings. And if I look at the performance of that, and this again takes out China, in the past 3 months, it's up almost 17% here. Looks like it's beating the index. And in the last month, up about 13.5%. Great conversation, Kevin. Really appreciate it. Kevin Carter, founder of EMQQ, joining us on the phone from San Francisco.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just about 17 minutes left in today's trading session. I heard Charlie breaking down the numbers. He's been on the market turnaround, still in the red for the S&P down at NASDAQ, but definitely off its lows of the session. But, you know, we're kind of driven from data point to data point and earnings release to earnings release. We've got some big ones after the closing bell.
Yeah, but is there something bigger happening? And how do we kind of draw all these earnings and results together? For that, we turn to Jimmy Lee, the founder and CEO at the Wealth Consulting Group. It's an independent wealth management registered investment advisory firm. They've got about $2.9 billion in assets under management. Jimmy joins us once again on the phone from Las Vegas. Jimmy, how are you?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's good to have you back with us. Okay, let's take a step back, not talk about earnings yet. I just want to get your views on the macro and the landscape that you're seeing, because I don't think we've been able to speak to you yet in 2023. What are you seeing as you look out?
I think what we are going through now is a shift from just a few weeks ago, from a lot more of the pundits believing that we're definitely going to be in a recession in 2023, and it's just not knowing how deep it's going to be, to where I think a lot of those bears have turned more bullish, thinking that we may actually avoid a recession. And so I think that the negative sentiment, although it's still very, very high, is a little less than what it was just a few weeks ago. And I think that's what we're seeing. So I think, good news, you're seeing money get put to work into risk assets such as equities, and also fixed income and bonds being a good place for investors this year, as many people think rates are going to stabilize and then go down at some point.
Yeah, it does seem like the conversation certainly has shifted over the last few weeks. But what do you think? Are we going to be able to pull this off?
Well, my base case has been all along that we could avoid a recession. I wasn't in the camp of we're definitely going to be in a recession. And, whether the Fed raises 50 or 75 or maybe even 1%, I don't think really that it matters that much. It's more about, are they going to, pause at some point, and when's that going to be? And certainly it's going to be in the first half of this year. Some people like myself think it could be as early as March. And if that happens, that would be a little bit of a surprise. And I think that would help, fuel this rally that we're seeing in stocks.
What makes you think, or what signs are you seeing that inflation maybe comes down faster than many expected?
Well, I've been kind of talking all along, or the last few months anyways, about just how big housing and shelter, which was the problem in last month's report, right? How big of that is a part of core CPI, nearly 40% of core CPI. And I think it's been well reported now that, the BLS collect that data with the rearview mirror. And everybody knows that housing market and rents have kind of stabilized, and it's been tough in the housing market. And so, when that data eventually gets into the inflation numbers, at least the headline numbers that the Fed's looking at, I think will look a lot better. And I think they'll be able to pause. And then I think that there's even a chance that they could lower before the end of the year.
Why do you think that they would lower? They've come out and said, as of last month, that they don't plan to lower.
You know what? I agree. In terms of the sentiment, not the sentiment, the statements and what people are listening to from the Fed members about how hawkish they're sounding. But, I think they can change that. So if we get weakness in the economy in the second half of the year from the high interest rates, I think that that would be the main reason that we could see some weakness, maybe even in the labor data down the road.
Jimmy, I'm looking at the notes you shared with our producer, Paul Brennan, and, the things or areas that you would be overweight in include something that shows an economy that's either turning around or is already turned around, and that's energy, industrials, materials, and financials. Is that safe to say that that's why that's your play, because you don't think we're going to be in a recession, and that you do think inflation will come down and that the Fed stops sooner rather than later?
Yes, and I also believe that China is a big part of a global growth story, especially for the Asian countries. And I think China will end up being a net positive for global growth this year. And so, yes, I think that that we avoid a recession, at least that's what I hope, and that I think a lot of asset classes, equities, fixed income, and real estate will have a nice bounce back this year. I still think we're going to be volatile for the time being, but, investors need to get positioned ahead of the pause. I think by the time, those words come out of Powell's mouth, I think stocks will be higher. And that's the main reason.
Okay, so a new client comes to you with a bunch of cash right now. How do you deploy it? I know it depends on their age, what their goals are. But how do you time? You can't time the market. We know that. How do you time the investments?
It's very difficult to time the market, but history has shown that in any given 12-month period, literally any given 12-month period going back, 75% of the time, the stock market's higher. So it's very difficult to not want to put the money to work knowing that. But usually we'll take the cash and add some into the portfolio that we want to invest into fairly soon, and then look at deploying the rest depending on what's going on in right. the recent news that we're headed against. And so, you know, I'd say maybe like a half now and half over the coming months type strategy is typically how we would do it, unless there's some sort of an event that we're watching out for and we'd want to wait for that.
Jimmy, just got about 45 seconds or so left here. Does it matter if that the real inflation rate that we get back to is not, or in the Fed funds rate that we get back to is not 2%, that it runs, that the run rate is higher, whether it's 4% or so, even 3%. Does that matter in terms of investment strategy for you?
You know, we're nearing the point where the Fed funds rate's crossing potentially, where inflation is, core CPI.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're getting to a point where rates really can be restrictive and can work on inflation. And so I think, you know, once we get inflation lower than where the Fed funds rate is, I think then we're going to be just fine. And so now, will that change Fed speak? I don't know. But I can tell you that I think there's a lot of money sitting in cash and money market funds and CDs that's waiting for a brighter outlook. Because still, even though that the sentiment has moved a little bit more positive over the last few weeks, I think that the negative sentiment is still pretty bad out there, and that's what people are hearing, at least retail investors are. So, but for us, I think that, the rates that we're getting to now is a more comfortable place.
All right, going to leave it there. Hey, Jimmy, thank you so much. Jimmy Lee, founder and chief executive officer of Wealth Consulting Group, $2.9 billion roughly in assets under management, joining us on the phone from Las Vegas.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.